representative on earth of the spiritual war that is going on in heaven. Now, who is that war in heaven between? Good and evil, the devil and his angels, versus Michael and the angels of God. With the result that the devil was cast down out of heaven. And where did he end up? He was on earth, right? And there he continues to make war against the rest of the offspring of the woman. Those who obey God's commandments and hold to the testimony of Jesus. Now, in making war against those who obey the commandments of God, how was this actually playing out among the people to whom John had written this revelation? Persecution. He'd started off trying to destroy the male child that was born to the woman. And I think we can all recognize that as being Jesus. Because to him was given the scepter of iron with which he would judge and rule the nations of the earth. I think we can all recognize that. So even very early in the life of Jesus, literally, even before he was born. I had one teacher that traced this line all the way through the Old Testament. The serpent had been told that the seed of the woman would do what? Bruise his head. Who was the first seed of the woman? Cain. Cain. The first child, male child, Cain. And what did the devil do with Cain? He captured him, didn't he? But there was one who was faithful. And who was that? The second child, Abel. What did the devil and Cain together do to Abel? Killed him. Way back there, the devil was trying to destroy that seed of the woman. But God had a plan. It was the third child. God didn't give up with two. He had a third. Eve had a third one and more. But it was through that third one then that the seed line began to be traced. Read over in Genesis a few chapters and what's happened to the whole earth. Evil. Continually on evil. And the whole earth was filled with violence. And it repented God that he had even made man. But there was still one man who found grace in the eyes of the Lord. And so you go on down through the history. Abram lived among an idolatrous pagan people. His family worshipped the idols. But what did God do? He called one man out of that and separated him to himself. Again, God intervened when it looked like the devil was in control. He was ready to capture that child. And you go right on through the Old Testament. During the days of the kings, there was one time when one of the kings of Judah was married to a daughter of Jezebel. And Ahab. Well, when her brother, who was the successor to Ahab, who was ruling in the northern kingdom, when he was killed by Jehu, who drove furiously, if you remember that story, and Jezebel was killed, then the daughter of Jezebel down in Judah was trying to take vengeance by destroying all of the descendants, all of the seed royal. And this was the family of David that had already been designated. But there was one child, an infant, who was spared, hidden by one of his nurses. And at the age of 8, the priest who was kind of leading the revolt against Athaliah, the queen, took the child and had him crowned king. The old queen came in and she yelled, "Treason! Treason!" But the priest said, "You're the one who's guilty of treason." And they killed her and reinstated the line of David on the throne. And so you go right on down. At the time of the birth of Jesus, Herod commanded the destruction of all of the baby boys born in Bethlehem at that time. What had happened? Joseph had been warned of God in a dream and took the child and fled to Egypt. And so it went. And then in the life of Jesus, how many times did they try to kill him before they finally succeeded? And I'm sure the devil thought he had won finally. Because by now, he's got it nailed down. You see, before, he didn't know who this seed of the woman was going to be. And so he started off with the very earliest children. But he spread it out. And then as God narrowed it down, he focused his attention on that one. And when it came down to Jesus himself, he knew that Jesus was born of the Virgin. Second.
There's a child between them that didn't evidently die or something.
We've lost track of it. We don't have any record of it. Yeah. So all the way through there, you can see this kind of thing playing out. The Amnon.
Is it Amnon?
Amnon was the one whom Absalom killed. Amnon. And Amnon was the heir apparent. Boom. And so on and on it went. But then, of course, God still had more in his plan than the death of Jesus. He had planned for that. It was also followed by resurrection. And so the seed, the male child, was preserved. And in the 12th chapter, he was caught up into heaven. And the woman was caught up. First in the wilderness and then later. And the devil tried to destroy her. And now when she was caught up under the protection of God in heaven, now he's making war against her seed, the rest of her seed. Those who obey God's commands. Now, chapter 13 says the dragon was standing down by the sea. And what came out of the sea? Well, the sea beast. What was the sea beast? Got a really a strange description here. He had 10 horns, 7 heads, 10 crowns on his horns, on each head a blasphemous name. The beast I saw resembled a leopard, but had feet like those of a bear, and a mouth like that of a lion. And the dragon gave the beast his power and his throne and great authority. And he goes on and talks about how the beast was worshipped by men and said, who can make war against him? He's invincible. Now, where have we seen in the Bible anything at all like this? Turn over to Daniel chapter 7. Now, instead of a beast, Daniel sees four beasts. In a dream. Okay, beginning with verse 2. Daniel said, in my vision at night, I looked, and there before me were the four winds of heaven churning up the great sea. Came out of the sea. Four great beasts, each different from the others, came up out of the sea. The first was like a lion, had the wings of a leopard, of an eagle. I watched till its wings were torn off. It was lifted from the ground, so it stood on 2 feet like a man. The heart of a man was given it. And there before me was a second beast, which looked like a bear. Raised up on one of its sides, it had three ribs in its mouth between its teeth. It was told, get up and eat your fill of flesh. After that I looked, and there before me was another beast, one that looked like a leopard. On its back it had four wings like those of a bird. This beast had four heads, and it was given authority to rule. After that, in my vision at night, I looked, and there before me was a fourth beast, terrifying and frightening and very powerful. It had large iron teeth. It crushed and devoured its victims and trampled underfoot whatever was left. It was different from all the former beasts, and it had 10 horns. While I was thinking about the horns, there before me was another horn, a little one, which came up among them, and three of the first horns were uprooted before it. This horn had eyes like the eyes of a man and a mouth that spoke boastfully. As I looked, thrones were set in place, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. Who's this Ancient of Days? Could that be God? I think probably so. His clothing was white as snow. The hair of his head was white like wool. His throne was flaming with fire, and its wheels were all ablaze. A river of fire was flowing, coming out from before him. Thousands upon thousands attended him. 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court was seated, and the books were opened. Boy, that sounds like something you read in Revelation, doesn't it? Then I continued to watch because of the boastful words the horn was speaking. I kept looking until the beast was slain, its body destroyed, and thrown into the blazing fire. The other beasts had been stripped of their authority, but were allowed to live for a period of time. In my vision at night, I looked, and there before me was one like a son of man, coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All peoples, nations, and men of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. What do we have here? Is that a picture of the ascension of Jesus into heaven from heaven's viewpoint? Where one like the Son of Man comes to the Ancient of Days, and he is given a kingdom, an everlasting kingdom, and people worship him. Well, but before that, what was on earth? What did he see in his vision before that? Four beasts. Now, these beasts, I think, parallel the four kingdoms that he talks about in Daniel chapter 2. where you've got the one kingdom of iron, of gold, another of silver, another of brass, and then another one of iron, with feet that were mixed iron and clay. And he said, in the days of this fourth kingdom, God will set up a kingdom which will never be destroyed. They kind of go together, don't they? Now, Daniel identified three of these kingdoms by name. He identified the Babylonian. You, O king, are that head of gold. He identified the Medo-Persian kingdom that succeeded him. He identified, that was not in those two visions, it was in another one. He also identified the Alexander the Great, the Greek king, who came from the west and destroyed the Persians. But his kingdom, single horn, was broken and divided into four. And sure enough, at the death of Alexander, his kings, his generals, divided his kingdom among themselves. And so you've got one that's over in the east around Babylon. You've got one that's in Antioch in Syria. You've got one that's in Egypt. And you've got one that's back in more in Macedonia. And then those fought against each other and among each other until the fourth kingdom came into being. Now, Daniel doesn't tell us that this was Rome. There's not much question about it there. If you read the fourth chapter. I remember one time I was reading a book called Caesar and Christ. It was one volume in the series by Will Durant, The Story of Civilization. I don't remember how many volumes there were. Ultimately, I had seven volumes, I think. And this was the second of the seven. And I started reading it may have been the earlier one, the earlier part of it, where it was dealing with the Hebrews and the Eastern kingdoms. But anyway, he started talking about the wars over Palestine in those days between the Testaments. And I thought, you know, I wonder if I could look in Daniel and see this traced out. And boy, it was just like laying them side by side, the historian and the scripture. Daniel chapter 11 especially, he talked about this. And you look over in the history book and there it is. He talked about the daughter of one of the kings being taken by the other one, or marrying her, and this kind of, there it is. It's all laid out, just right down the line. I mentioned this. This was before I went to Sunset School of Preaching. I mentioned this to Johnny Ramsey, one of my teachers when I was there, about having seen this, and he kind of laughed. He said, you know, said, I think that Durant used Daniel as his outline for that section. And he may have, for all I know. But boy, you could sure see them there lined up side by side. And in Revelation, some of the same imagery is used. Now, I suspect that the same imagery has similar meanings. Now, in Daniel, it's pretty obvious that these were pagan kingdoms that were oppressing God's people. The Babylonians? The Medes and the Persians weren't quite as bad and oppressing, but they weren't righteous people either. The Greeks, especially in that intertestament period, not so much in the days of Alexander, but in the days of his generals after him, and the Romans. Now, the Romans had a time when they were benefactors as well. But that didn't last, did it? And so what happens in Revelation is all of these oppressing pagan governments are brought together into one single beast. Now, were the Babylonians and the Medes and the Persians still around? Not really, were they? But their descent, their successor governments were. Just like when the Greeks were gone, they influenced Rome, but Rome had the power. But the Greeks still had some influence, especially in philosophy and culture. They controlled the minds of men, whereas the Romans controlled their bodies. And all of it was opposed to God's people. But we're not through with Revelation chapter 13. In verse 11 he says, "Then I saw another beast coming out of the earth. He had two horns like a lamb." Now in Revelation, who is the lamb? Jesus. He had two horns like a lamb, but he spoke how? What does this sound like? Okay, there's some authority here in the dragon. The dragon is giving the first beast his authority. And he's exercising all the authority of the first beast, which is really the authority of the dragon. And now this land beast is speaking like a dragon, even though he looks like a lamb. Got two horns like a lamb anyway. And he is a miracle worker. He performed great and miraculous signs, verse 13, even causing fire to come down from heaven to earth in full view of men. And because of the signs, he deceived the inhabitants of the earth. He ordered them to set up an image in honor of the beast who was wounded and yet lived. And through his influence, men came to worship that beast, the first beast. And if they refused, then they didn't get the mark of the beast, and they could not buy or sell until he had the mark. Here's some of the persecution. But it was persecution that was focused around false religion. In particular, the deification of the Caesars as God. So here they turn Caesar into God, and you must worship him. And if you don't worship him, then you don't have the mark that says that you have the right to buy and to sell. You can't get work. You can't go to the store and buy anything. You can't take anything that you make on your own and try to sell it to other people. If you do, you're subject to persecution. Now, Caesar didn't require very much in the way of worship. All he required was that once each year, you would go and you would take a pinch of salt and you would throw it on the altar and say, "Caesar is Lord." To the Romans, that was almost like a pledge of allegiance. But to the Christian, what was it? It was blasphemy. There is one Lord. The Christian believed, And so he would refuse. Some of them, I've read, said, but we've got to live. And some of their teachers said, must you live? What must you do? Must you live? Is that the sole purpose of your being here? To live? Or must you glorify God? So, there are the two on the side of the dragon. Persecuting government and false religion that is subservient to that persecuting government. But at the beginning of chapter 14, we have another vision. Then I looked, and there before me was the Lamb standing on Mount Zion, and with him 144,000 who had his name and his Father's name written on their foreheads. Notice the one had the mark of the beast. This group has the name of the Lamb and the name of the Father on their foreheads. You see the difference? Well, I would say so. That's what Jesus said when he was on earth in the Sermon on the Mount, wasn't it? The broad way that leads to destruction, the narrow way that leads to life, and few that find it. I don't know that the 144,000 represents represents a smaller number, but I think in reality it does. Anyway, who are these 144,000? Verse? Yeah. Not that long. Yeah, they for a long time though. But these are the ones who have been redeemed from the earth. They were singing a new song before the throne, before the four living creatures and the elders. This takes us back to chapter 4, doesn't it? As part of that innumerable multitude that surrounded the throne. Mount Zion. There's an expression that has a lot of history in the Bible. First time we read about Mount Zion, you know what it is? It was a fortress of the Jebusites in the city of Jerusalem. And when David became king and he went to capture Jerusalem, he had to take this mountain, Mount Zion. Well, he made it his home. Mount Zion was where the king's palace was. David's palace. But then it came eventually to stand for the whole city of Jerusalem, because that was the seat of authority. That was the seat of government in Israel and in Judah. And Mount Zion, later it was called the city of the great king. Now who was the great king? Well, David was, but David gave allegiance to another king. Who was that? That would be God himself, wouldn't it? God. David, as he was, people were bringing materials for the temple. He prayed, and there in the end of 1 Chronicles, he said, yours is the kingdom. Yours is the power. Yours is the authority. And we're just men. Now, other kings of Judah didn't recognize God as being the great king. But David did. And that is the reason David was always the ideal king. Not even Solomon. Solomon's physical glory may have been greater than David's. But spiritually, where was Solomon? Well, he married all of his foreign wives. He made temples to their gods in Jerusalem. That wasn't the act of a king who was in subjection to the great king, was it? And because of that, his kingdom was taken from him, from his son. And his son retained only a small part of it. But then when you come into the prophets, you see that there is a future Zion that is being talked about. And ultimately, here it is. Ultimately, it's here in heaven. But before it was in heaven, where are we standing? Where have we come to? Hebrews chapter 12. You've not come to Mount Sinai, to a mountain that quaked and trembled and had the fire. But you are come to Mount Zion, to the city of the living God. Hebrews chapter 12. You've come to the spirits of just men made perfect. You've come to that innumerable company, to that general assembly in the church of the firstborn. By the way, that firstborn there is plural. He's not talking about Jesus. He's talking about the church of Jesus. They are the ones who are firstborn. Yes, he was our predecessor in being firstborn from the dead. But here he's talking about all of us collectively. We are the firstborn. We are the church of the firstborn. To that mountain which cannot be shaken. Kingdom, which receiving the kingdom, which cannot be shaken. And that is Mount Zion. But here, is he talking about the church? I think probably so. At the end of the book, you see this caught up into heaven. The church caught up into heaven and Zion, Mount Zion, becomes heaven itself. Okay. Mm-hmm. In the same sense, I think that in 2 Corinthians, in 2 Corinthians 11, verse 2, Paul says, I'm jealous for you with a godly jealousy. I promised you to one husband, to Christ, so that I might present you as a pure virgin to him. Okay? I think in that sense he's talking about being pure and preserved for the Christ. Because later in this revelation, we see the church as the bride of Christ, radiant and glorious and pure. So I think this is a preview of that. I'm sure they find some kind of justification for that here. But I wouldn't trust their interpretation of passage. Now, these are there. They're singing a new song before the throne in verse 3. No one could learn the song except the 144,000 who'd been redeemed from the earth. These are those who did not defile themselves, who were pure. And they followed the Lamb. They're identified even more closely. They were purchased from among men and offered as first fruits to God and the Lamb. No lie was found in their mouths. They are blameless. That describes the church. Then the angels with their messages. Verse 6. I saw another angel flying in midair, and he had the eternal gospel to proclaim to those who live on the earth, to every nation, tribe, language, and people. He said in a loud voice, "Fear God and give Him glory, because the hour of His judgment has come. Worship Him who made the heavens, the earth, the sea, and the springs of water." Wait a minute. I thought the preaching of the gospel was put in the hands of men, not of angels. What about that? Remember that the literal meaning of the word angel is messenger. Every preacher of the gospel is a messenger. And in that sense, it's an angel. Okay? He's not talking necessarily here about the angels of those spiritual beings that just reside around the throne of God. He's talking about those who are carrying the message of God. At least that's my opinion. The second angel followed and said, one is preaching salvation. Notice the next one, though, is preaching damnation. Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great, which made all the nations drink the maddening wine of her adulteries. And then the third one preaches judgment. A third angel followed them and said in a loud voice, if anyone worships the beast in his image and receives his mark on the forehead or on the hand, he too will drink of the wine of God's fury, which has been poured full strength into the cup of his wrath. Judgment day is coming, brother. Get ready now. Isn't that the message? He will be tormented with burning sulfur in the presence of the holy angels and of the Lamb. And the smoke of their torment rises forever and ever, and there is no rest day or night for those who worship the beast and his image. What did Jesus promise to those who would come and learn of him and take his yoke upon them? You will find rest unto your soul. But here there is no rest for those who worship the beast in his image. This calls for patient endurance on the part of the saints who obey God's commands and remain faithful to Jesus. This is one of the key verses in the whole book. Patient endurance on the part of the saints who obey God. Do we still need patient endurance today? You know, the devil never changes his objective. He may change his tactics, but he doesn't change his objective. His objective is to tear us away from God. Now, in the first century, with the severe persecution, he tried to tear the Christians away with threats. But it only made them stronger. Did some of them fall and listen to the threats? Yeah. But the ones who left, who were the ones who stayed, were stronger. Stronger. And they constantly grew stronger. What kind of strategy does he use today? Threat? Fear of what?
Destruction. Taking away that your livelihood, your health. Mm-hmm. That fear to us that we want to hang on to. Sometimes people live with us to feel like if we curse God and die, we can be buried. Mm-hmm.
There is that at times. Is that the strongest appeal that threat he has against us? What is the strongest threat that he has against the church today? Apathy? Love of pleasure rather than love of God? Love of ease and comfort?
Deception.
Deception.
Yeah, because he feels like, it seems like what was once good, we say, now that's bad, and what was bad is good. It's changed. Mm-hmm. And that was the same thing with Jesus. That happened. Well, mm-hmm. He was not going to make you good, but if you got to make you good.
Just flip things around.
He said, no, he don't want you to be like him. So
cultural infiltration of the church is probably today in America. Not necessarily everywhere, but in our country, in the Western world as a whole, really, Europe, U.S., Australasia, Australia, New Zealand, countries like that, South Africa. The biggest threat is cultural infiltration of the church. We become like the world around us, even though we still think of ourselves as the church.
Mm-hmm.
Or very little. Mm-hmm. Now, are there still faithful individuals? Absolutely. There are still, as God said to Elijah, He spoke of the 7,000 who've not bowed the knee to Baal. And 7,000 there could be taken not as a literal number, but as one of these numbers of completeness. There is still a remnant that is faithful. But the biggest threat that we face is that apathy. And that being satisfied with ourselves. And being satisfied with where we are. And wanting to be served rather than to be servants. Yeah.
Where are they at?
Where are they?
Not here.
Mm-hmm. Where is everybody? As Jesus said to the lepers, where are the nine? To the leper, where are the nine? Were there not 10 cleansed? Where are the others? In that case, there was 1 out of 10 that was the remnant that returned to give thanks. Well, he continues. Okay, look in verse 13. Verse 11 said there's no rest day or night for those who worship the beast. Verse 13 says, Then I heard a voice from heaven say, Write, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on. Yes, says the Spirit, they will rest from their labor, for their deeds will follow them. No rest for the wicked. There is rest for these who die in the Lord. Verse 14 to the end of the chapter. Contrast two different harvests. There are two different sickles. Actually, there are two different sickles mentioned here. In English, it's just the one word sickle. But there are two different ones that are involved. The first one is the sickle with which you reap grain. I looked, and there before me was a white cloud, and seated on the cloud was one like the Son of Man. We know who that is, don't we? With a crown of gold on his head and a sharp sickle in his hand. Then another angel came out of the temple and called in a loud voice to him who was sitting on the cloud, "Take your sickle and reap, because the time to reap has come, for the harvest of the earth is ripe." So he who was seated on the cloud swung his sickle over the earth, and the earth was harvested. This is the sickle that reaps the grain. You remember when John the Baptist was preaching? And some of the people thought he might be the Christ. And he said, "No, there's one coming after me who is mightier than I." And he said he's going to gather his grain into his harp, into his barn. But the chaff is going to be burned with unquenchable fire. There was a separation of the grain from the chaff. Okay? Then in verse 17, he says, another angel came out of the temple in heaven, and he too had a sharp sickle. Still another angel who had charge of the fire came from the altar and called in a loud voice to him who had the sharp sickle, "Take your sharp sickle." Now this one was not the grain, not the one for cutting the grain. This was just a kind of a hook that they used in picking grapes. Okay? It was different. Not the one you'd go out to do the wheat with, but the one that you'd use for the grapes. And he talks about grape harvest here. "Gather the clusters of grapes from the earth's vine, because its grapes are ripe." The angel swung his sickle on the earth, gathered its grapes, and threw them into the great winepress of God's wrath. They were trampled in the winepress outside the city, and blood flowed out of the press, rising as high as the horses' bridles for a distance of 1,600 stadia, which my footnote says is about 180 miles. Now see if you can imagine 180 miles of blood as high as a horse's bridle. The earth is being harvested in the winepress of God's wrath. Chapter 15 will talk about the pouring out of the bowls of wrath on the earth. Begins there. 15 and 16. Those are very striking chapters, aren't they? Okay. Next week, I guess Cletus will be back.
Now, I wasn't here for the helper.
He is taking part in a study of a new medication for Parkinson's.
Okay.
And he has an appointment down at the clinic that is doing this in Tampa.
Gotcha.
Early tomorrow morning. And so he's spending the night down that way so he can be there in time. Okay. He called me yesterday and asked me if I'd be able to take the class. Let's pray. Our Father, help us to see vividly the world as it is, and not just as it appears to be. Help us to see ourselves as we are, and not just as we think we are. Help us to see the spiritual dimension to all of life, and that everything that we do in one way or another either builds us up or tears us down before you. And we pray, Father, that we may walk with you, that we may be built up in Christ and preserved from the dragon and his cohorts. It's our prayer through Jesus. Amen.